On Thursday's Morning Edition reports on your health. And today, we focus on the health of teenagers who will be on the football field this weekend. Many high school and college teams will be playing in the last of the summer heat, and it is not easy for those players to stay cool. Reporter Deborah Franklin explains why.
It's not just the heat or the humidity. It's the uniform. Ernest Lomax is a lineman for Dematha High School in Hyattsville, Maryland. His team's been running sprints and other drills for a week, but this is their first day practicing in full pads.
Right now I got shoulder pads on, I got two shirts under this, and I got sweatpants and a girdle, and then my basic underwear, and then I got my helmet.
There's a reason why he's wearing all those layers. Back in 1905, football was nearly banned from college campuses. 18 students had died on the field that year, mostly from head injuries and broken necks. That's why helmets came along and better pads. But that makes players hotter, too. And these days, heat stress kills at least one or two healthy high school or college football players a season. And it sends a whole lot more to the hospital.
It's not uncommon during prolonged intense exercise for us to be able to measure temperatures in athletes of 103 or 104 degrees Fahrenheit.
Larry Kenny's a sports physiologist at Penn State. He says that an 80-degree day with 90% humidity may feel safe to the coach who's in shorts and a T-shirt. But for the player on the field in full pads, it's another matter.
The equivalent insulation to a typical football uniform is like wearing a wool three-piece men's business suit.
Plus, the player's got on a helmet that acts like a toaster. His sweat can't cool him off because it's not evaporating. It's soaking his clothes. And chances are he's still dehydrated from yesterday's practice. Back at the Dematha High School football practice, the players are breaking for water.
Come on, let's go.
Bill McGregor's been head football coach at the school for 26 years, with 16 conference championships to his credit. He wants to turn these kids into great players, but he also takes heat seriously.
You talk to them by common sense. You know how you feel. I do not. Okay, if you feel you're lightheaded, if you feel you need water, okay, go take care of it. Nobody's going to call you a sissy or a chicken or a baby or whatever they used to call you in the old days.
McGregor follows NCAA guidelines to get kids acclimated to the heat of August. That means no pads the first week.
They made us run. Coach wanted to see who has heart, so he ran us all for a good 1 or 2 hours just to see who wants to play football, who wants to make this team.
Ernest Lomax says he and his teammates push hard.
We like to wait till they tell us we should stop rather than we stop on our own.
That may be why you ultimately can't count on the kids to put the brakes on, the coach says. He remembers one boy who gave nothing but 100%.
2 years in a row, we had to call the ambulance the first day of practice and get him to the hospital for dehydration. I should have been smart enough the second year to realize, as a football coach, you have to know your kids. Now, ever since that happened, we try to identify who's the kid who will just push himself till he can't stand up.
Playing safe doesn't take fancy equipment, but McGregor says it does take more adults on the field during practice, including somebody you can designate as a lookout coach.
Even a parent, you know, just look. You have big eyes, and you know, you see what's going on, and somebody doesn't look like he's feeling too good, go over, put your arm around, and see what's going on.
And sometimes you even need somebody to face down the coaches.
Last year we had a game where the heat was just excruciating, and I wouldn't let them play the game.
Wendy Norris is Dematha High School's lead athletic trainer. And if it's too hot by NCAA guidelines, Norris says no football.
I just couldn't let them. You know, I had a few grimaces and growls and such from the coaches, but they know it's the right thing to do, and that's what we did.
You're going totally across your body, right?
Coach Bill McGregor admits he may grimace sometimes, but he says in the heat of the late summer, a trainer like Wendy Norris is the most important person on the field. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Franklin.
Keeping hydrated is the key to keeping cool on the field or elsewhere, and you can get tips on how much and what to drink at npr.org/yourhealth.
Even though Columbia, Missouri is a small city with around 100,000 people, it's long sustained two daily newspapers. One of those papers is attached to the University of Missouri, which has the country's oldest school of journalism. But like a lot of dailies, it's struggling these days. Sarah Whitmire of member station KBIA has more.
For the past century, Columbia's had two papers. The Tribune is the evening paper. It's been in the Waters family nearly since the beginning. The Missourian is the morning paper. It's located on the University of Missouri's campus and staffed by faculty editors and student reporters.
What else have we got cooking that you all are going to be working on that we can expect through the weekend? Yeah.
The Missourian is still able to compete with the larger circulating Tribune because it's subsidized by the university. But with the school in financial straits and looking to make cuts, the Missourian is a target because it's running a deficit expected to exceed $1 million. But those who work at the Missourian say it's more than just a newspaper. It's about maintaining a training ground for the nation's journalists. Chad Day is the assistant city editor at the Missourian and edits his fellow students' copy. He says what the Missourian offers is sink or swim training.
See anything come in obit-wise, just go ahead and pick it up and then just let me know and write the last name down in obit.
What I'm reporting on are the same thing that a professional newspaper is reporting on anywhere else, and we hold ourselves to the same type of professional standards.
Some think the paper should only publish online. Others argue it should continue to be subsidized as much as necessary by the university. And some are calling for a partnership with the city's second daily, the Tribune.
And Henry J. Waters III. I'm known as Hank more than Henry J.
Hank Waters is the editor and publisher of the Columbia Tribune. Not surprisingly, he likes the idea of working out an arrangement with the Missourian. In exchange for picking up printing costs, the Tribune would keep the Missourian's ad revenue and gain access to its highly desirable campus readership.
There's some very good student newspapers and other print newspapers at other journalism schools that are not commercial. They didn't try to go out and compete in the marketplace, but they provided good standards for kids to write. That part's important.
It's clear that Hank Waters is a businessman who needs to turn a profit. It's less clear how his style would jibe with the mission of what he terms a student newspaper. The two papers have always been competitors, and some criticize any arrangement with the Tribune as getting in bed with Hank. Dan Potter is the general manager of the Columbia Missourian. He's heard from alumni and community members since news of the paper's financial situation broke and says it's clear they don't want the paper to get very far away from what it's doing now.
I have a very romantic view about the Missourian. We give birth to so many people that go on to become managing editor of the New York Times or Jim Lehrer, you know, who's a graduate of ours. We give birth to so many people that make such a difference to this country and democracy that I think we're one of the most important daily newspapers in the world.
Many of those alumni who started their careers working at the Missourian return to campus next month for the paper's centennial celebration. But the party will take place under a cloud of uncertainty. The publishing board isn't expected to reach a decision until after the centennial. In the meantime, all those connected with the paper will continue to search for answers about what to do with both the Missourian and the declining fortunes of newspapers across the country. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Whitmire in Columbia, Missouri.
This is the day the College Board releases its annual report on how high school students performed on the SAT test. A year ago, less than one-half of 1% of students got a perfect score, 2,400, in the combined math, verbal, and writing sections. It's hard not to be impressed when somebody does that, but there is a school where this happens with regularity. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports on how they do it.
There's a small high school program in Baltimore, Maryland, where getting perfect SAT scores has become, well, kind of old hat.
Excuse me. I'm looking for the folks in the Ingenuity Project.
It's next door, 37.
Okay, thank you.
Housed in Baltimore's Polytechnic Institute, the Ingenuity Project has attracted some of the city's brightest public school students. Since 2001, the program has produced 13 perfect SAT scores, and one man gets lots of the credit.
My name is Michael Goldenberg, and I was born in Ukraine,
Goldenberg, a gifted mathematician, once taught mathematics in Moscow's best schools. He emigrated to the U.S., settled in Baltimore, and was hired by the Ingenuity Project in 1997. Here, Goldenberg has mentored several students who got perfect SAT scores, although truth be told, he doesn't think much of the SAT.
It's extremely easy.
Maybe, compared to the rigorous coursework students here take. Beginning in 9th and 10th grade, advanced calculus, trigonometry, physics, advanced biology, chemistry, technology, and the classics and literature. On the other hand, says Goldenberg, the SAT is a measure of a student's patience, persistence, even maturity.
And that is why, finally, I like the test. It's a good predictor of how developed the person is.
Well-rounded, says Goldenberg. That's a better word. One student immediately comes to mind, Robert Watkins III. He had a perfect score back in 2001 when the SAT still had two sections worth 1,600.
There was nothing on it like we didn't know.
Watkins credits Professor Goldenberg and the academic rigor and challenging work at the Ingenuity Project.
As far as the perfect score thing, I mean, it's a lot about how well you take tests, but it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all of, like, you know, predicting what someone's future will be or what they'll do.
What Robert did was go on to Yale, then law school at Columbia University. Now he's a patent lawyer in New York City. Did Robert's SAT score help open each one of these doors? Absolutely, says Seppi Bazili, an expert with Kaplan, the test preparation company. But, he adds, we've gone overboard attaching a lot of other things that the SAT just doesn't measure.
We've heard about investment banks that ask you for your SAT scores, and my mom, who's a realtor, makes sure that on the front brochure of her hometown, she proudly displays the average SAT score of the local high school, because we're obsessed with numbers. I mean, the SAT, it's really only designed to do one thing, to tell colleges how students will do in their first year of college.
And that's it.
And that's it.
And even that, experts say, is debatable. So it's unlikely we'll ever know if success on the SAT has anything to do with success in life. Still, at the Ingenuity Project, this year there's a 10th grader who's already gotten a perfect 800 on the math section of the SAT. And no one at the school is about to play that down. After all, she could be the next perfect 2400. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
For months, we've been following two teenagers from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, as they struggle to pay for college. Marlo Johnson and Emmanuel Garcia graduated from one of Harrisburg's best high schools. But like many college-bound students this year, they spent the summer frantically searching for loans and grants to cover their tuition. As the school year begins, NPR's Claudio Sanchez has the story of how things turned out.
This is Sanchez and Emmanuel Garcia.
Emmanuel Garcia, 18, could hardly contain himself when he called me to share some good news for a change. Earlier this summer, he and his parents had failed to raise or borrow the remaining $5,000 he needed for college this fall. Plan B was community college. But then something totally unexpected happened. An NPR listener offered to help Emmanuel after hearing his story.
She said she was touched by it and she was willing to give me money to help me go to college. I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. Bye.
Several days later, I sat down with Emmanuel in his home across the kitchen table and talked about his good fortune.
That lady, she had to be good luck because the next day I found out I get this, I found out I get that. Everything worked out miraculously.
This and that included a huge last-minute scholarship from the Pennsylvania Board of Governors, a generous combination of federal grants, work study, even a small loan from Shippensburg University, a state school where Emmanuel is going to major in business. As for that lady who called Emmanuel out of the blue, offering help, he's going to call and tell her.
Thank you for offering, but, you know, everything worked out, and, you know, I don't have to take your money.
Emmanuel will be the first in his family to go off to college. But there was another student in this story, 17-year-old Marlo Johnson.
I feel like I kind of failed in a way, to be honest. And that
discourages me.
Marlo ranked third in her graduating high school class and left with glowing recommendations from teachers. But nothing thrilled her more than being accepted by a prestigious pre-med program at Susquehanna University, a private college with a $38,000 tuition. The school wanted her so much, it gave her a $15,000 scholarship. But Marlo and her family could not come up with the rest of the money. No one was more discouraged than Marlo's mother, Carmen Johnson.
I thought that we would at least be able to get the federal loans. I was really shocked when that didn't happen.
Mrs. Johnson, a legal secretary, then looked at how much her family was going to have to borrow for Marlo's first year of college, nearly $20,000. She was floored by the high interest rates banks were charging. So she told Marlo there was no way she could ever take on that kind of debt.
And she kept saying, well, Mom, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. I was really upset. I felt like I failed her in a way because I couldn't save up for money for her to go to school.
Marlo's father has been in and out of hospitals, forcing Mrs. Johnson to dig deep into the family savings, including Marlo's savings for college. Living paycheck to paycheck, she says, that's what being middle class means these days.
So our kids don't go to school. What do we get? Nothing. We're on our own.
Many parents feel the same way, says Michael Reed, the principal at SciTech High, the school that Marlo and Emmanuel graduated from last spring.
I mean, right now it's estimated you would have to put $300 a month 18 years before a student goes in to pay for a college education. If a family has to decide between putting the $300 a month or putting food on the table, they're going to put food on the table.
It's a choice that has hit parents at this school especially hard. SciTech High School is the most academically rigorous school in Harrisburg. Almost all its students are poor, immigrant, minority kids. It's no longer enough to be ambitious, really smart, and academically prepared for college, says Reed. Increasingly, it's all about what your family can afford.
It should not be, in this day and age, this difficult for any student to get into higher education, particularly when they're qualified.
Reed says it's cruel for kids to work so hard and then have college doors slammed in their faces because they couldn't come up with the money for tuition. That's what happened to half of the 60 students who graduated with Marlo and Emmanuel last spring. Some have postponed college altogether. Most, including Marlo, have enrolled in community college. She's given up her dream of attending Susquehanna University, but like always, Marlo's looking on the bright side.
Well, I do have enough to pay tuition, thank God. $1,750 each semester, so I'm covered for the year.
We'll be checking in on Marlo and Emmanuel later this fall. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.